Good morning. I'm Leslie Thatcher, 8:06 on this Thursday, April 16th, 26 degrees here in Old Town Park City. On the phone with us from the ABC Forecast Center, it's Erica Martin. Good morning.
Good morning. So I'm dealing with a few things here locally. We felt another aftershock, but in Park City, no earthquakes or aftershocks for you there. We are tracking some snow showers, northwesterly winds, anywhere between 10 to 15 miles per hour. As the day progresses, the winds will start to calm down a bit more and be variable. So they're going to have a southerly component later on in the day and variable throughout the next couple of days. We're tracking a system that's going to dive on in or dive on up from the south. It's a little bit of a disturbance, so we could see some more showers, snow showers for you through the overnight hours. Temperatures for today in the mid-30s, and then overnight lows only in the teens, so be mindful of that. On Friday, upper 40s. We're going to stay that way through Saturday, and then tracking some more showers, rain, snow mix, and then eventually snow through the overnight hours on Sunday into Monday. So, guys, have a great day.
Erica, thank you. KPCW News Time now, 8:07. And as she mentioned, again, another aftershock registering 4.2 magnitude. Very similar area there near Magna. And, of course, it's the Great Utah Shakeout Day, a day to raise awareness about earthquake safety. You can find out more about what you should do and practice today in by going online to shakeout.org/Utah. KPCW News Time now, 8:08. And with a look on in the backcountry on the phone with us from the Utah Avalanche Forecast Center, it's Nikki. Good morning.
Good morning. So it kind of feels like a return of winter. Mountain temperatures are in the mid-20s at trailheads and upper teens at ridgeline. Winds are currently averaging 10 to 15 miles per hour, with gusts near 20 miles per hour at mid-elevation and gusts up to 50 miles per hour upper elevation. Since yesterday morning, the central Wasatch has picked up 6 to 11 new inches of snow. Today, these snow showers will continue through mid-afternoon before the skies clear and temperatures drop. We could get another 2 to 4 inches of snow throughout the day. Yesterday in the backcountry, both Drew and Trent found that the best riding conditions was in the low-angle smooth terrain, so low-angle trees, areas like that. Yesterday, there were a few reports of shallow avalanches in the snow. Most of these were fast-running slush failing on the firm melt-freeze crust that came before the new snow. The two things that we're going to want to look for today are the wind-drifted snow and new snow. So we've had elevated westerly winds for a couple days. That's going to blow that new snow into shallow drifts of wind-blown snow. These will primarily be on the upper elevation ridgeline or steep slopes that face easterly. But since winds have been gusting above 50, cross-loading is possible, and you could find it on almost any aspect. Today, just look for any obvious signs of wind-drifted snow, such as pillow-shaped slopes, cracking, lumping, and avoid those. As well, Drew noted yesterday that the cornices are getting large and growing. While the cold temperature should kind of lock them into place, increased wind and new snow will add a load to them and could push them past their tipping point. For those, just give them a wide berth, as they can break back farther than expected. The second issue is just going to be that new snow. So in areas that aren't affected from the wind, we'll have that light density snow. It could be both long-running slush and steep terrain or shallow soft slabs. Look for obvious signs of instability, such as cracking or sloughing. Today, the avalanche danger is going to be moderate at all mid and upper elevations for those two reasons. As well, evaluate snow and terrain carefully and pay attention to changing weather.
Okay. Hey, Nikki, thank you. KPCW News Time now, 8:10. Well, reacting to the economic impacts of the coronavirus lockdown, the Summit County Council yesterday approved a set of budget reductions amounting to a decrease of nearly $3 million. KPCW's Rick Ruff reports the county officials are expecting that this is the first of two phases of budget cuts that they will act on this month.
The council approved a package of reductions that amount to a decrease of 4.8% in the 2020 budget, according to the county's chief financial officer, Matt Levitt. Levitt and county manager Tom Fisher said that following those cuts of nearly $3 million, they're working on reductions of about $2 million more. They hope to present those to the council next week and for a vote on April 29th. Of the spending cut Wednesday, a little over $1 million comes from cuts to staff salaries and benefits. They have imposed a hiring freeze on 15 or 16 open job positions. Fisher said only one of those spots he would consider essential, a cook at the county jail. The county also won't be making a contribution to a 401k fund for staffers. Maybe the biggest pill to swallow is delaying merit pay increases until the end of the year. Levitt said that saves the county about $450,000. He said while some staffers got their merit hikes earlier in the year, the delay going forward impacts some 65% of the employees. However, Levitt did say the cost of living adjustment, or COLA, was implemented for the entire staff earlier this year. Levitt did say that an unscientific sampling of the staff found that they have a selfless attitude toward the budget cuts.
In an unofficial survey among staff and employees, most of them were willing to give up both their COLA and their merit if they could in order to preserve other employees' jobs. So it's difficult to say, but it was one that employees, like I said, is unofficial survey, but employees were willing to give that up so that others could, so that we could preserve jobs as best as we could.
Council member Kim Carson said that although more painful news is probably coming, she appreciated the attitude of the staff. Council Chairman Doug Clyde seconded that.
From my perspective, our truly greatest asset is our employees, and we just have a full complement of extremely good employees at all levels, and rest assured that it is my highest priority to make sure that they feel that they're working in a stable work environment.
Levitt said that other cuts in the budget came from cutting back on some studies, maintenance, material and supplies, reducing the spending for training and trips for staffers, taking payments for the county fleet and deferring or spreading those out, and not making a contribution of $750,000 to build up their fund balance. For KPCW, I'm Rick Broth.
KPCW News Time now, 8:15. And stay tuned. Coming up, we're scheduled to talk with Summit County Councilmember Chris Robinson. Later on in the hour, National Weather Service hydrologist Brian McInerney will talk a little bit about the spring runoff, what's ahead for him, as well as he retires from the National Weather Service at the end of the month. Finally, Park City Film Series director Katie Wang with details on the virtual film programming that they're offering while the Jim Santee Auditorium has been shuttered. Also, stay tuned. Coming up on today's edition of Cool Science Radio, right after the local news hour, the guests include George Zidon, who has written the book Ingredients, The Strange Chemistry of What We Put In Us and On Us. Then Brian Green, whose new book is Until the End of Time, A New Exploration of the Cosmos and Our Quest to Find Meaning in This Vast Expanse. All of that coming up on Cool Science Radio this morning, starting at 9:06. Also, just a reminder that KPCW is joining stations all over the country to celebrate April 16th as Public Radio Music Day. All day long, you can hear messages from our volunteer Air Force about their favorite songs as that they hear here on KPCW, a great way to celebrate the special role that non-commercial radio stations like KPCW play in the music world, both locally and nationally, and we hope you will stay tuned. Again, reports of another aftershock, 4.2, located in Magna, have had people tell us that they have felt it in Kimball Junction, Pinebrook, Tollgate, Blackhawk Station, Old Town, Prospector. So, yeah, great way to wake up. And, of course, it is the Great Utah Shakeout Day, a day to raise awareness about earthquake safety. You can find out more by going online to shakeout.org/Utah. Well, COVID-19 has put extraordinary strain on hospitals and providers of health care. One highly reported shortage is in personal protective equipment, referred to as PPE. Masks are particularly in short supply everywhere. KPCW's Carolyn Murray has a look at some local efforts to produce and send out mask covers to those facilities most in need.
Basin resident Julia Collins calls herself a sewist, but it's not her full-time job.
No one would know based on the number of masks she's jammed out over the past weeks. She just sent 60 colorful cotton mask covers to a couple of hospitals out of state.
60 to date have been sent to St. John's Hospital in Wyoming and the Presbyterian Medical Center in New Mexico.
Collins says a friend, also a sewist, told her about the Sewing for Lives website. A Utah woman started the program to connect hospitals and healthcare professionals in need of mask covers with those who are willing to sew them. Listed on the website are hundreds of facilities all over the nation, addresses, and a count of what they need.
It has both a Facebook site and a website where you can learn about the different patterns, the patterns that hospitals or medical facilities are asking for, and then actually select where the mask covers that you're making will then go, essentially a matchmaking site for sewists and medical care facilities.
Collins says the website and Facebook pages gives enough direction on what each healthcare facility is looking for. There are also tricks of the trade that people share with one another.
You know, previewed by other medical facilities and said, yes, we will accept these. So it alleviates that type of concern that you're making the proper mask or mask cover for the medical facility. And then also through that Facebook forum, you can see what other people are doing, whether they're shortcuts with sergers or shortcuts with folding or ironing or, you know, just all these tips and tricks.
Park City resident Lori Stevenson has been sewing all her life. She wanted to help make masks and donate them to local facilities. She thinks even after the initial COVID crisis passes, people will be wearing masks for a while.
Well, actually, I started looking for an organization to hook up with for distribution. And I was looking for local hospitals to donate to, but then I found that they're not really accepting homemade masks. So I just started sewing for friends and family.
After some research, Stevenson found a pattern she thought looked good and went to work.
It looked good. It's got a filter pocket, and it has a nice snug fit around your face. And I've seen a lot of people walking around with surgical masks with like big gapes on the side. They're not very efficient. So I thought we could do better than that. So I found a pattern and downloaded it, just started sewing.
You can find the link to sewingforlives.com on kpcw.org. You can also see pictures of the masks Collins sent to hospitals in need. I'm Carolyn Murray, KPCW News. Newstime now. 8:20. Good morning. Well, the Summit County Council, as we reported yesterday, approved some $3 million in budget reductions yesterday, and the county staff hoping to come up with another $2 million in suggested budget cuts soon. So on the phone with details, I have Summit County Council member Chris Robinson. Good morning, Chris.
How are you, Leslie?
I'm doing well, thanks. So we're only 4 months into this fiscal year, and we're talking about a total of $5 million in budget cuts for this year. Any idea what cuts would be involved for the next $2 million, Chris?
No, not really. I mean, I think we wanted to get ahead of it early with this first $3 million, and they were low-hanging fruit. About a quarter of the $3 million is $750,000 that we intended to add to fund balance, and some of the other elements were freezing hiring and making adjustments to our already announced merit increases in salary and some other measures that won't have obviously the merit does to the employees, but they're not drastic cuts. But the next phase is going to be more difficult, and we wanted to take more time to implement it.
Yeah. So have you personally heard feedback from employees? Because, again, yesterday's cut was a bit over $1 million coming from cuts to staff salaries and benefits.
They weren't necessarily cuts. Rolling back some proposed increases. So I haven't heard individually from anybody. I would hope that most people realize that we're all in this together, and that it's not business as usual, and that we need to make adjustments.
So you anticipate the cuts going forward will be increasingly painful?
Well, one of the pieces that we don't know and we hope to know in the next couple of days is whether the legislature gives us the liberty to, during this fiscal year adjust some of our siloed revenue sources and gives us liberty to redistribute them as needed to deal with the pandemic. And that will be helpful. You know, we might have dedicated hospitality taxes or dedicated transportation or transit taxes where promoting tourism or, you know, taking the next steps on transit or transportation may not be in the critical path. And so I think that knowing what tools we have before we start doing surgery might be helpful.
Have you seen the proposed bill? Has a bill been written?
There, I'm not personally monitoring that. I mean, it's happening in real time in like less than an hour from now when it's going to start. I do believe that there is a bill. It had been embargoed, but it should be on the street soon if it isn't already. That would give some latitude.
Okay, so do we have a lobbyist down there making the case?
Yes.
All right.
Yes.
During the meeting, it was briefly mentioned the tax stability fund, the rainy day fund. To dip into that, you'd have to have voter approval. And to do that, to put it on the ballot, you'd have to pass a resolution by August, sometime in August. Are you thinking that you would favor doing that?
You know, I've been down this road once before, as you remember, years ago. We haven't really spent any more time on it than what you heard in yesterday's session. I think we got a lot of time to decide between now and August whether or not we need to do that. Obviously, the Tax Stability Fund is there for a reason, but we don't really know where we are yet, and we don't know what these other tools might look like that we may get from the legislature.
All right. County Manager Tom Fisher gave a presentation on the COVID recovery plan. There was some lively discussion when Councilmember Dove Clyde raised a couple of concerns. His perception was that this plan sprouted wings pretty fast and that the entire council wasn't made aware of it. I had heard about it. Did you?
Yeah, I think that it did happen fast and it needed to. I mean, it's unfortunate that there were some communication breakdowns. I saw a draft of the plan earlier in the week, but it was a subset of the council that had been reviewing it, and we got a little ahead of ourselves. There was discussion of possibly, and this is a plan that we've been working on collaboratively with Park City Municipal Corp, and I think that there was talk of maybe rolling it out tomorrow. I had suggested that we're getting ahead of ourselves. Not only has the council not seen it, but we ought to see what the legislature does, because some of the proposed agenda items for the special session have been to provide more oversight to local health departments and county actions in regards to these kinds of emergencies. And also the state's working on a version 2.0 of Utah Leads Together. And so I think that we're going to be pushed back into next week and we'll get all back on the same page. But it moved pretty fast.
Yeah. So we had thought we were going to hear about it today, but you're saying it'd probably be next week before we see some of that. Or is this separate than kind of the business rollout plans?
What was the second part you said? Is this separate from which plan?
Kind of the business rollout plan that Rich Bulla talked about yesterday with us.
You're going to see that. This is separate.
Okay. All right. Doug Clyde also wanted to know who's in charge of this kind of lead, you know, the Lead Together program that the county's putting together. And along, again, we've got city council member, we've got Dr. John Hanrahan, we've got Becky Kearns, Miles Rademan, Katie Wright. Tom Fisher emphasized that he doesn't consider it a county plan, but Doug thinks that it should have a parent and it should be the county. So what's thinking here?
Well, I think that the key point to it is that it needs to be a collaboratively drawn up and a consensus plan that's not a top-down edict. And I don't know exactly how to take Doug's comment. I think that the important part is that you know, what's been happening for a while, and rightfully so, is the messaging from the county has been health orders shutting things down, and now we need to start thinking about you know, and the analogy to a dimmer switch, not a light switch, but that you can increase or decrease the intensity, that we need to start turning the dial on how we do that. And so I think it needs to be involve industry and local government or nonprofits. And that's what we've tried to do, and our businesses. And so I don't know if there's a grand chieftain of the plan. I mean, we've tried to have it drafted by community leaders that have broad respect and that are cross-cutting. And I don't know exactly how to say more on that.
All right. The council also spoke about rent relief, although the council doesn't have the authority to dictate this. I think council members were hoping to persuade some local landlords. And I guess, what is it that you would ask? Because, of course, some landlords have mortgages of their own to pay.
Yeah, I mean, it's a domino effect. I think all we could do is suggest. We don't have any teeth to mandate anything like that. And as a landlord and as a tenant, I think that most people in that situation realize that there's got to be some give and take. I mean, it does no good to evict a tenant now when there's likely a paucity of tenants and when the duration of the non-performance is, you know, maybe short, and to make a transition in the middle of a torrential stream to new tenant, then, you know, there'll have to be some forbearance by definition, I think.
Okay, and finally, wanted to ask you about the council reappointing three Snyderville Planning Commissioners, Candace Hart, Joel Fine, and Thomas Cook. So basically, you're endorsing the status quo. You think that they're doing a good job.
It takes, a year or two just to become really a contributor on the Planning Commission is as detailed and complex as ours. And those three you mentioned have done well, and they have matured in their positions, and we think they are doing a good job, and don't think it prudent to switch horses when they've now really gotten used to the harness and are pulling well.
Okay. Anything else you want to mention, Chris?
No, I think not. I think we're taking things, doing the best we can, but we're, you know, we're vigilant.
All right. Thanks for your time this morning.
Thank you.
At Summit County Council Member Chris Robinson. You're listening to the Local News Hour here on KPCW. It's 8:31 now. Good morning. I'm Leslie Thatcher. Well, the National Weather Service has released its latest water supply briefing that looks at the current and future water patterns as we approach the spring thaw. On the phone, I have from the Weather Service, hydrologist Brian McInerney. Good morning, Brian.
Good morning, Leslie.
So first of all, I mean, the news here is that on your most recent post, you announced that you are retiring at the end of the month?
Yeah. It's been 30 years with this job, and I'm finishing up at the end of the month.
Wow. And then what?
I'm looking to ski more and ride my bike more, but I've got a nonprofit with some professors at the U called the Utah Climate Project, but we're having issues raising funding for the nonprofit. It's kind of tough to get funding in the climate at the federal level these days. And it's based on climate change and how it affects the cities around the state, but we're working at it, but we'll see how it goes.
Yeah. And I remember in the days where, you know, as a National Weather Service employee, you couldn't even mention the words climate change.
Yeah. How about that? It was, it was quite a stretch where I would work it in just on water supply briefings. I wouldn't really talk, use the word climate change, but indicate that things are warming and then talk about what was happening with our weather conditions and what's projected. But yeah, you couldn't even say the word climate change or even talk about the subject matter, which was kind of bad.
So over those 30 years, I mean, what's changed the most in terms of weather forecasting?
I think we've gotten better because the technology's gotten better. The computing power to quantify the atmosphere has improved. And then I think the idea that we used to just put the forecast out and say, we're the weather service, here you go. Now we've gotten much better at saying, who's the target audience for this forecast and what does it mean for you? The fire community. You know, wildland fire or flash flooding down in southern Utah or water supply, or these are just things I did, but they also have roads for transportation, how the weather affects that. I think we've gotten much better at that with an overall improved forecast.
All right. So do you have a replacement at this point?
There is talk that with the budget, with the weather service, they might not fill my position. That's just kind of a rumor that I've heard. I hope that's not the case. But I do have a person who has been training with me for the past 2 or 3 years who do a great job if they open the job. But with everything with the federal government right now, it's in flux, especially in the field of science and weather forecasting. The Weather Service's budget has slowly gotten smaller and smaller over the years. So we'll see. If they do hire the person, he'll do a really good job.
So he's currently.
But we'll have to see if they open it.
Yeah, he's currently working with the Weather Service then at this point. It's whether or not he
is. Yep. Yeah, he's a meteorologist right now, but he's worked with me as doing the hydrology duties over the past 3 years.
Okay. And kind of as the hydrology, that's what you've kind of always done. I mean, you kind of use the weather reporting, how it will affect our water supply. Is that close?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. It's actually four parts to this job. The first part is water supply during the winter months. Then we have flash flooding with intense thunderstorms in southern Utah. We warn for those events and try and educate the parks and monuments how it all works. And then I work with the Forest Service, their bear teams, after wildfires to predict debris flows when we have thunderstorms. And then I was the climate change person for the entire career. So all four of these things were really interesting and really dynamic, and it was really a great career to have because you could switch your topic every season to something new and different, and that was very stimulating. So not only did every year change with each topic, but you got four different topics that you moved through, and that was the hydrology program. And I was the first one there 30 years ago. I was the intern when I showed up. They didn't have a program. So I designed it, which I thought the most benefit in what people were looking for. And it turned out really well. It was really a great career. I really like working for the Weather Service.
Yeah, I bet. Well, with the ski season shutting down a month ago instead of last weekend, I mean, it feels like it should already be May. But no, we're still in mid-April here. So going into the spring thaw, where do we stand? Because I don't think we're really there yet.
Yeah, we're not there. I mean, as we look right now at my window, it's snowing, and that's a good sign. Anytime you can delay the melt as long as possible, keep snowing, keep cold, keep wet into late May, and then flip the switch, turn the heat on, bring the sun out. That's what you want, and that's what we're doing right now. As far as the amount of snow on the ground, we're doing okay. We're about average. In Park City, when you look at how we measure snow, it's right about 100% of median, which is where you want to be. You always want to have more snow because that snow is overlaid on very dry soils from the hot summer we just had. And that's something we're going to lose some of that snow water equivalent into the soils, and we're not going to see it in the reservoirs. But overall, our snowpack is right about normal. And then when you translate that into a water supply forecast, we're right around 80 to 85% as far as the Weber Basin goes. We're most likely about 80%. If you look up in the Bear, we're expecting about 100% right on normal. And then Six Creeks, which is the area by Salt Lake County, you know, from Little Cottonwood around to City Creek, they're about 95% of average. And that's the volume of water coming out of the mountains from April 1st through the end of July. And then when you go farther south down in Utah Lake, they're only about 70%. And that's due to the flow of the storms this year. We're mostly out of the northwest flow, and that favors Six Creeks, the Weaver, and the Bear. Southwest flow favors Utah Lake, and we didn't see much of that this year.
Oh, okay. Southwest flow also kind of affects the Wasatch Back snowfall. So,
yeah,
you get the better storms on those southwest flows. So in terms of what we're looking at then, I mean, we're still seeing freezing temperatures overnight, some cool days, snow days, and what we're just kind of hoping for is kind of a gradual climb in temperatures as opposed to all coming at once come May.
Yeah, that's probably what's going to happen. We're just going to slide into it as we get to the end of April when you get seasonal temperatures that are going to start warming up. The key was not to start warming in March. When we've done that, you get so much loss to evaporation. The plants come back early. They pull the water up through the roots. They transpire it out. You don't want to start melting in March. And we've even seen some years in January recently where we had melt going on in the north aspect of the Uintas, and that should look like the Arctic up there. And that's a little disturbing that we're slowly making our winter time smaller and smaller. It's starting later. It's ending earlier. So anytime you can delay the melt, that's what we're looking for, and that's what we're doing so far this year, and that's great.
So when you talk about the Weber River being at 80 to 85% of median, that means we're down from the overall median. What does that mean, though, then for future, you know, for this summer's water supply and storage?
I think how we need to look at it is to how much water do we expect to come out of the mountains this year? And then we then say, well, how much water do we have in storage? And when you look at the reservoir contents, really throughout northern Utah, we're in really good shape. We had an excellent year last year. And then the water managers this year, when we met with them in January, when we could still get together and talk about the forecast, they've held back releasing as much water as they can. And what that has done is we've got water in, like, say, Deer Creek is 93% full right now, and the runoff hasn't even started. Jordanelle is at 85%. If you look over in Pine View, they're at 76%. So our reservoir storage is the be-all, end-all for water supply. That's what you want to – you want to fill the reservoirs, and it looks like we're going to do that this year to a large extent, except for the big ones like Lake Powell. They're only about 45% full. We're looking really good as far as water supply goes. You want to have above average years every year to give them a little wiggle room so they can let water out or store it. But they've done a good job storing water right now, and we should hit it just right as far as what's coming out of the mountains and what's going to fill the reservoirs.
So what determines when we can call ourselves in drought conditions, and are we looking at that for at least this summer?
Yeah, a good chunk of Utah is in pretty sizable drought, and that really is due to the heat that we've had and the dry summers that we just got through. At the beginning of 2019, we were in some pretty severe drought, especially in southeast Utah. That area in the Four Corners area continually has drought for the most part. They were out of it for a short period, and then they went right back into it. So when you think of drought, we're at moderate to severe drought over a good chunk of the state. And that's going to lighten up a little bit. We're just considered abnormally dry down about Utah County south of there. But northern Utah is pretty much drought-free when you look at where we are right now. But that's only going to get worse over time, over the long haul, you know, out to 2100 as we're drying out in Utah right now. And the farther south you go, the drying is increased. And that's just due to how the storms and how the jet stream is affected by our warming climate. So we have to expect this. We have to kind of plan for it. But we're going to be in drought for quite some time. The problem with southeast Utah, why that area is in drought so much more, is southwest Utah gets these atmospheric rivers. Like at the beginning of the year, they had two atmospheric river events around Christmas time, and it put the snowpack at 200% of median, and that was almost their season. seasonal amount of water, just in two events. Southeast Utah doesn't see those atmospheric river events. And then when you get northwest flow that affects our area, they're still shut out. So they're kind of in this pocket that doesn't see the bigger global weather patterns, and they're going to see more of this over time.
Okay. So looking long range, did we name this past winter? I mean, was it an El Nino, a La Nina? And I mean, if we were to look at next winter, I mean, pulling out your crystal ball, what are we looking at?
I think the way we were in ENSO neutral this year for the most part, or maybe a weak El Nino. And so we're going to be in neutral conditions. And when you think of forecasting weather, we can do it for really about 5 days out, maybe 7 days if all the models agree. But after that, mathematically, it falls apart trying to quantify the atmosphere. So for us to say what's going to happen next year, we have to kind of look at dry and wet patterns. 2019 was wet. 2020 was average. 2018 was doable. And so you need to look at dry and wet patterns over time. Typically, you don't have more than three wet years in a row before you switch weather pattern shift. So I think at this point, to say next year would just be a wild guess. I don't think we have any good skill beyond 7 days to say what's going to happen next winter. They're working on trying to figure this out, but the atmosphere is so dynamic and it has so many variables that to try and quantify what's going to happen is pretty elusive. So I would think if you look long term, you know, and if we go out 10 years, we're going to be drier, we're going to be hotter. I think those two things really paint the picture for what Utah is going to see. Right about, probably Ogden, maybe Salt Lake, north of there into Canada is expected to get wetter. South of there is expected to get drier. But as we're warming, the evaporative losses, when you look at the water budget, indicates that everything is going to get drier. And when the storms do get here, they will be more intense, but they'll be less frequent. And we're seeing that right now. We don't see as many storms as we used to. But when they do show up, they're very potent. And then we have long periods of storms without. Last 2 years have had some pretty good flow all the way through for the two-year period. We haven't seen high pressure dominate our weather for like the entire winter like we've seen some years. That's going to be more in our future also, and that's kind of depressing, but that's kind of the way it goes. So kind of a drier, hotter atmosphere over time. But we're doing it right now. When you do the statistics on stream flow, everything is drier than it used to be. And that's just going to get worse over time. But as far as next year, it's just kind of a guess at this point, I would think.
Okay. Well, Brian, gosh, thanks for all of the interviews over the, we've been talking to you for probably 30 years, but thank you. And best of luck to you. And actually, we hope to check back with you at some point and talk a little bit more about your Utah climate project. So we'll get back with
sure.
you.
Yeah, I live in Park City.
Yeah.
I'll be around. And I've totally enjoyed working with the radio station over all those years. You guys do a great job with information and being the source. So it's all been really good stuff.
All right. Well, have fun, boy, in retirement. Sounds great. Thanks.
Yeah, thanks, Leslie.
That is outgoing National Weather Service hydrologist Brian McInerney. Again, after 30 years, he'll be retiring at the end of the month. You're listening to the Local News Hour here on KPCW. Well, with the closure of the Jim Santee Auditorium due to the spread of COVID-19, that means that the weekend screenings by Park City Film were also shuttered. However, there is still opportunity to watch a slate of films from the comfort of your own home. On the phone, I have the director of Park City Film, Katie Wang. Good morning.
Good morning, Leslie.
So when were you able to get these virtual offerings set up?
So we closed our doors on Friday the 13th, an auspicious day, as it turns out. And on the 26th, we were able to launch our virtual cinema. And that's a huge tribute to the film distributors and the Art House Convergence, which is a group of nonprofit art house cinemas across the country, just kind of coming together to see how we could support each other. I mean, certainly the sales for virtual cinema support us as theaters, but it also helps the film distributors generate some revenue during this challenging time. So we were able to launch with Fantastic Fungi, which is a great film about the medicinal and environmental purposes of mushrooms. And it's a film we'd actually shown in December, and they had already been planning a nationwide release on that day. So we're able to participate in that. We had a live Q&A the next day. There were three different times during the day with the director, Louis Schwartzberg, and Paul Stamets, who's one of the main characters in the film. And yeah, it's been kind of going gangbusters since then. New films are coming on every week. We've already shown about six films, and we have two more coming on today. So in an odd way, we're able to show more films because we're not limited by our one screen. But certainly, you know, we miss having everyone in the theater all together to see these films at the same time.
Yeah. So are these the same films that you were going to offer on the upcoming calendar?
You know, some of them are, which has been really exciting. You know, as I said, Fantastic Fun is one that we're interested in participating in that national screening. So that happened. Right now we're showing The Woman Who Loves Giraffes about Dr. Anne Innes Dagg, who was one of the first people to study giraffes in the wild in Africa. So a groundbreaking female scientist. Corpus Christi is online right now, a film from Poland that was nominated for Best International Film for this year. So those were two films that we'd hoped to bring in that now we're bringing in. And then Once Were Brothers, the story about Robbie Robertson and the band, which was a great film for us to bring in that we had actually hoped to reopen in April with, but of course we're still closed. But that's an interesting backstory on that Magnolia Pictures, who's a distributor, said, you know what, we're all in this together. We want to make sure we get through this together. So for the first week, they offered 100% of ticket revenue to go straight to the theater, and now it's a 50% split, which is what we're seeing with all the other tickets. So, you know, a huge tribute to them, thanks to Magnolia Pictures for just going that extra mile and saying, not only are we going to make these films available to our community, but we're going to try to get some more revenue to our theaters.
Yeah. So are you getting a good response?
You know, it's been moderate. We're talking to other theaters. We're still waiting for numbers to come in. It's not as, you know, immediate as when we are selling tickets at the door. We've heard great responses from people online. People have been emailing me, you know, asking some technical questions about how do you hook it up here to TV. I would say HDMI cable is a great thing to invest in right now because streaming's been a little slow. But people love the Q&As. You know, it's not going to be the same as filling a 450-seat theater, certainly. But what's nice is that it does offer people a different opportunity than what's available online through Netflix or Amazon Prime, because these are current films that are coming out. Ticket prices are about $12. Some are a little bit lower, but they're trying to equalize the pricing across the country, because now, of course, someone in New York or California can watch our film. So that's kind of another opportunity for us to reach out to our community and say, hey, if you like these films, share it with your family and friends across the country, because all of those ticket sales come back and benefit Park City Films. So, yes, it's kind of an interesting mix. But no, I mean, not the same numbers. We're mostly doing it as a way to, you know, keep connected with our community and, you know, keep independent cinema, you know, alive and well and thriving, so that when we are able to open, hopefully in the not too distant future, there'll be, you know, we'll have the revenue sources to be able to do that.
Yeah. So the are you still receiving then 50% of the ticket price, if you will?
Yes. Yep. Okay. Yep. So for all the tickets now, a couple of them are slightly different.
Yeah.
But for any ticket that you buy in the virtual cinema, I would say kind of rule of thumb is half of that ticket price goes back to us, mm-hmm. Which is great. So obviously our operational costs are less than they were when we were open. But of course, we're not seeing the same volume of people coming through the door and no popcorn sales, sadly. But yeah, we're encouraging people to make their popcorn at home and send us some pictures of their bowl so we can share that kind of aspect of Park City Film together.
All right. So how long are you offering the films when they come up?
Right now, we've been doing two-week runs, again, longer than we normally would, which were normally a three-day run for our films. Some of the films, like Once Were Brothers, have done really well, so we're offering it for longer. So that we can still generate some revenue and people can share with their friends. We are looking to offer some films for free. It's kind of our real community series model, where we're able to have Q&As after the film, have it be a few free community screening. So we're looking at a film about Toni Morrison with the Park City Museum for May. So it's a little bit trickier to manage those because people have to watch the film and then have the Q&A, and we're trying to figure out, do we do it all at the same time, or do we let people kind of do it on their own schedule and then have the Q&A at a set time that people can Zoom in or you know, do Facebook Live for that. So it looks like in the offerings each week, new films keep coming online. We're actually showing a film from our archives. We opened 25 years ago on March 30th, 1995, and one of our first films was an old Western called 1,000 Pieces of Gold. So we'll actually be showing that towards the end of this month. So it's kind of exciting that came online just serendipitously at the same time, and there'll be a Q&A with Chris Cooper, who's in the film. So kind of a fun timing on that. But yeah, each week I would say anticipate about two films coming in, and then they'll be available for about 2 weeks once you rent them. Usually the rental lasts for between 48 and 72 hours. So if you have to stop in the middle, you can pick it up at a later time or watch it again if you really liked it.
Okay. And Summit County is hoping to hear from business sectors, and I'm guessing the arts organization is part of that. Have the art organizations put together some kind of plan about how you possibly could gather safely in the coming months so that some of the venues could be opened?
You know, there hasn't been a formal conversation about that. Certainly as an art house theater, as I said, we're part of this larger national group. We're all talking about social distancing. You know, will there be limits on ticket sales? We're fortunate that our venue is 450 seats. So if we're limited to 50 people or 100 people, certainly doable. If you had a theater that was only 125 seats, that would be hard to maintain a 6-foot distance and even get to a 50-person audience number. So I've been talking with the city. We'll follow guidance from the health department. They haven't asked us for a formal plan, but that's certainly something that we're thinking about. And, you know, we'd like to open as soon as we can, but obviously we won't do that until it's safe to do so.
Okay. Anything else you want to mention?
So we do have, we retooled our weekly e-newsletter. So normally we would send out a weekly letter saying once a week, saying here are the films coming up and kind of give a description. We've now made that immediately. We made that into a 2-week, we get sent it out 2 times a week. And it has, of course, information on the virtual cinema, but also film recommendations. We're trying to do them around themes to kind of keep it interesting. We did a pairing of films with wine. We'll do some films, of course, for Earth Day next week. But that's free to anyone. So if you go to parkcityfilm.org, you can sign up for our e-newsletter. As I said, it comes twice a week. Just give you different insights into films. We have the Friday Film Reviewers make some recommendations. And then, of course, we hope that everyone will participate in our virtual cinema. These are great first-run films, and please share them. You know, anyone in the world can watch these films, and all of those ticket sales benefit us. So we really appreciate the support from the community. You know, we really need this revenue so that we can open up and it's safe to do so, and, of course, continue to pay our staff in the meantime so they'll be around to help us open our doors. So parkcityfilm.org, and thanks to everyone for their support and kind emails. We miss you.
Okay. Hey, thanks, Katie. Katie Wang is the executive director of Park City Film. You're listening to the Local News Hour here on KPCW. Well, today is Public Radio Music Day, and KPCW is joining stations all over the country to celebrate. All day long, you'll hear messages from our volunteer Air Force about their favorite songs they hear here on KPCW, a way to celebrate the special role non-commercial stations like KPCW play in the music world, both locally and nationally. So we'll hope you will stay tuned throughout the day. The Utah legislature is convening a special session this morning to deal with some pressing issues regarding the impacts that the COVID-19 outbreak has had on the state budget and education. The legislature convening in its first ever virtual session this morning. State Representative Tim Quinn says the full House did a dry run on Monday with the new technology that will allow lawmakers to see one another and the Speaker of the House as each piece of legislation is discussed and voted on.
There'll be a way for us to be in real time while we're in session reading comments and statements and concerns and opinions about each piece of legislation from our constituents as we're there in the special session.
He says the public will also be able to comment on each piece of legislation and lawmakers will be able to electronically raise their hand for floor time. The governor has put lawmakers on notice that the special session could last as many as 10 days. That's the legal limit for a special session. Quinn says he's already planning to be in session at least through tomorrow. The special session has a number of issues for lawmakers to consider, 21 of them, and include everything from accepting federal funding to passing a resolution urging state and local governments to exercise fiscal responsibility with their budgets. Even though lawmakers just spent 45 days earlier this year piecing together a budget for next fiscal year, Quinn expects several amendments to it.
No one expected what we're in, where it's my understanding we could be as much as $1.5 billion off from a revenue side. Not only that, Leslie, but we moved in accordance with the federal move from April 15th to July 15th filing date. So many people pay their taxes when they file. So there's a 3-month window there that we go without revenue that we normally would have. So yeah, there's a lot from a budgetary standpoint that's going to have to be done, and the budget will be drastically changed. And departments, both state and local, will be asked to tighten your belt through this pandemic until we come out and our economy is healthy and strong again. So, yeah, there's a lot of moving parts to this. I think that's why they said 10 days is a possibility.
Lawmakers will also consider a number of issues dealing with education, such as waiving the requirement for year-end statewide testing, granting a waiver for seniors who must pass a civics test as a condition of their graduation, and addressing the existing requirement that educator evaluations be conducted. Proposed legislation will be made publicly available online in advance. Quinn says that he has already received some input from a couple of constituents, and he encourages others, if they have something to say, to call or email him. Citizens can also comment on specific legislation online at le.utah.gov. Floor proceedings will be streamed and on the legislative website and broadcast on television on KUEN Channel 9.2. KPCW News Time now, 9 o'clock. Twenty-nine degrees here in Old Town Park City with snow showers mainly before noon, mostly cloudy otherwise with a high of 39, maybe an inch possible. Looks like things are clearing up though for tonight, and expecting some sunshine tomorrow with a high of 46, 49 on Saturday. Now looks like some unsettled weather on Sunday for us. You've been listening to the local news hour here on KPCW Park City. We've got headline news coming up, followed by Cool Science Radio. It's 9 o'clock.